we do become conformed to Jesus Christ in all things. So we pray in his name. Amen. This is a serious topic. We have 9 chapters. It's the first book of the book of Proverbs. About 3 chapters, about a third of it, is devoted to this topic of the smooth woman, or the seductress, or the adulterer. And so in this first 9 chapters, from the father to a son, he's going to focus today on the peril of Dame Folly. About adultery, we're going to look at Proverbs 5 through 7, a deadly deception. And this truly is, adultery is deadly. This is Lady Wisdom, rather simple-looking lady, pretty, granted, but this is Dame Folly, nicer package. And here's what Lemuel said about this woman. Lemuel, a Gentile king, Proverbs 30:20. This is the way of the adulterous woman. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I have done no wrong. To her, sexual desire and the sexual act is no more than being hungry and eating a sandwich. He wants to use women to personify a system which leads men and women along a path or a way that leads to destruction. And Lady Folly leads men to loss of life's real quality, leads men and women to a loss of even physical life. When you go through this, it seems like all of the onus of blame and responsibility for this deadly deception is on women. It's not intended to be that way. In fact, in reality, most infidelity is not initiated by women, but by men. And the culture is informed basically by men who are leading us into this path. Now, there's a man named Bob Diffenbaugh out of Dallas, Texas. He's a preacher in Texas. And he said something I think that I wanted to say to set this up. He says, I do not think Solomon intended for us to conclude that it is most often the woman that seduces the man. Rather, I believe Proverbs pictures Madame Folly as the aggressor because she personifies the evil way. Now, I took that quote and I thought about it a little bit more, and I said, and here's what the reality is, we are in a battle with Satan, a person. And Satan seeks to draw men away from God into the evil way. And the seducer in Proverbs is a woman because she, Madame Folly, personifies sin overall versus Lady Wisdom, who personifies righteousness. And the focus in the book of Proverbs is on behavior and destiny. Evil behavior and righteous behavior end in a destiny that's totally different. And the writer of Proverbs starts with the warnings and the applications and then gives an illustration. For us, that's backwards. Every sermon we hear, it starts with an illustration and then come the warnings and the applications. I'm going to do it that way. So I'm going to take this section, Proverbs 5 through 7, and I'm going to start with the illustration. So I'm going to start in Proverbs 7, the smooth woman, a lesson in folly. Here's the outline I'm going to use. 7:1-5, the smooth woman, a lesson in folly. We start off by looking at 7:1-5. Wisdom will protect you, folly will kill you. Let's look at 7:1-5. My son, keep my words and treasure my commandments within you. Keep my commandments and live, and keep my teaching as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers, write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding your intimate friend, so that they may keep you from the adulteress, from the foreigner who flatters with her words. Now it says here that wisdom is like a woman who will protect you. She's like an older sister. Think of the example of Miriam, who protects and watches over Moses as he's placed in a basket in the Nile. Watching, wanting to see what's going to happen, and she sees wisdom work in concert with God's providence. Because what happens? Pharaoh's daughter come and take him up and take care of him. That's providence. But it is wisdom that allowed her to be the concerned older sister who is willing to protect him. But folly, on the other hand, is the immoral woman. She's marked by seduction, flattery. She sounds good. She looks good. But her life leads to death. And wisdom is something that we gain and we possess. It's like sight. And that's what he says in this first verse. Keep my commandments and live, in verse 2, so that what? My teaching is like what? The apple of your eye? That's an expression for the pupil. What lengths will you go to protect someone from poking you in the eye? How valuable is your sight? Wisdom and knowledge are like the apple of your eye. You'll go to any lengths to protect it. Let's go to the story. A view from a private window. Here's the story. Here's how we break this down. There's the victim, verses 6 through 9. Let's look at that. For at the window of my house I looked out through my lattice, and I saw among the naive, that's the pati, the patiim, the simple ones, I discerned among the youths a young man lacking sense. And that perfectly describes the naive, someone who has very little experience and doesn't have enough knowledge. You would say this guy is as dumb as a box of hair at this point. And he sees this young man, lacking sense, passing through a street near her corner. Now, he knows who he's talking about, but I don't know if the young man knows who's there. And he takes the way to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the middle of the night, and in the darkness. So this is twilight, which is only going to go to darkness, only going to get darker. And what happens in the dark? That's in the dark when you can stumble. It's in the dark when you can be attacked. Someone can sneak up upon you. But it's in the dark that he's trying to convey that evil things take place. Now, his point of view. This is the teacher describing a man watching from a window high above the street, overlooking. His point of view in the story is, in a sense, he's godlike. He sees everything below, but he's unseen by the people below. They don't know he's watching. And he's looking at this simple man, no experience. He's alone. He's uncommitted. You could say what he's seeing in this young man's mind is, I'm going to go down here and I'm going to just see what's going to happen. I'm going to see what exciting thing I can stumble upon. The young man doesn't realize where he is exactly. He just knows he's in a dark place. He has no plan. He's all by himself. Now let's look at the hunter, 10 through 12. And behold, look. A woman comes to meet him, dressed as a harlot and cunning of heart. She is boisterous and rebellious. Her feet do not remain at home. She is now in the streets, now in the squares, and lurks by every corner. She is like on a troll. She is like a fishing net. She's looking for a victim. And notice it says that she's dressed like a harlot. She looks good. This is a beautiful package. She is cunning of heart. You know, that's the same word used in Genesis 3 of the serpent. Cunning, in the sense of being able to perceive what people are thinking and what people want. It's what Jesus told his disciples, be innocent as dove, but as wise as a serpent. Be cunning. So you can be cunning for good reasons as well as bad reasons. She's not here for good reasons. She has vast experience. She is totally committed to a goal, as opposed to this naive young man. She's a beautiful package, but the teacher looks down on her and says, what's her heart? She has a cunning heart. She has a wicked heart. The teacher, quote, sees the heart. How does he see her heart? She's boisterous and rebellious. Her feet are not at home. That's actions, isn't it? Yeah. That's her actions, her behavior. See, the book of Proverbs is all about behavior, is a reflection of your heart. Okay, so let's look at her tactics. 13. She seizes him and kisses him, and with a brazen face, she says to him, now, see, this is a very confident woman. And you know what? The strange thing is, this is the kind of woman men like. Someone who is brash and confident. Man, I'm out there. I was due to offer peace offerings today if I paid my vows. Therefore, I have come out to meet you. And this is emphatic in the Hebrew. I've come out to meet you, to seek your presence earnestly, and I have found you. I have spread my couch with coverings with colored linens of Egypt. I have sprinkled my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. Come, let us drink our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with caresses. For the man is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He has taken a bag of money with him, and at full moon he will come home. With her many persuasions, she entices him. With her flattering words, she seduces him. Well, stop there and go back and look at some things. This verse 13, this is shock and awe. She grabs him, she kisses him. And men are suckers for affection. And she says, let's celebrate. This is a special day. Everybody gets drunk on Christmas, right? Everybody gets drunk on New Year's. No, really, isn't that what society says? This is a holiday. This is the day you let your guard down, right? Then she flatters and she promises all these sensual thrills. And this is where the passion comes in. It's the assault on the imagination and the senses. She smells good. She looks good. She kisses him. That's tactile. She puts in his imagination this picture of this bedroom with these smells and scents. All of these are senses. And the senses affect the heart. Your behavior reveals your heart, but it's the senses that affect that heart. And she must, however, sense some sense of hesitation, though she knows through the kiss and through the description of what she wants to do, she knows that the fire of lust has been lit in him. And so she's got to do this nudge. Look at verse 19. Look, this is perfectly safe. My husband is gone. He's taken a bag of money, and he's going to be gone until the new moon. That could be up to a month away. Because this holiday she's talking about could be the new moon feast. In the full moon, he will come home. And then, see, here's what she says in verse 21. With many persuasions. These are all the things she said to him. And this final promise is, he's gone. You're safe. All things work together for evil in this case. But we know the verse is all things work together for good. But in this case, she's packaged all these things together and she gives him the nudge. The thought never occurs to this simpleton, never occurs to this idiot. He's talking to a woman that's willing to betray her own husband. And that's treachery. And that's her character, and never occurs to him. And his heart is on fire with lust. Therefore, his mind is in a stupor. The deadly decision he makes is 22 and 23. All at once. Notice that. That's how the verse starts. All at once, like in a moment of time, he follows her. As an ox going to slaughter. Or as one in fetters to the discipline of a fool, totally terrible translation in the New American Standard, and also the King James, until an arrow pierces his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare, so he does not know that it will cost him his life. He doesn't see that his decision will have consequences that he has absolutely no control over, and it will lead to his death. It's safe. Nobody's going to know. I can do this. He doesn't see the treachery. He doesn't see the danger. He only pictures the thrill and the sensual release. Here's what Hubbard says. Sexual immorality anesthetizes our judgment. Adrenaline shoots through our systems. Hormones race about in our bodies. Our nerves are all tingling. And nothing less than sheer mayhem as a result. Hubbard, page 88. Now, there's a really interesting and neat verb progression here in verses 22 and 23, and I have to point it out. There's three verbs. He goes, he comes, and he hurries. 22 and 23. He follows her as an ox goes. And then the better translation is in the ESV, the RSV, or the NIV, which says something like, or as a stag or a deer is caught till an arrow pierces its liver. That's the better translation. In fact, supported by the Septuagint, which supports the translation of the ESV and the NIV. So really, you have to read this as this, that suddenly he follows her as an ox goes to slaughter, or as a stag is caught fast till an arrow pierces its liver, and as a bird hastens to the snare so that he does not know that it'll cost him his life. Notice it says the ox goes. How does an ox go to slaughter? Picture this. Have you ever been in a packing plant where you see the cows? They put the cows in chutes and they walk to where they're going to be slaughtered. In Israel, they would use a goad to guide the ox toward the knife where he would be slaughtered. They would just goad him up and the ox would walk along. Ox had no idea how this walk was going to end. But he was guided along. See, this woman has guided this young man from the very first kiss. Dumb like an ox, we say. But see, there's another element. The other element is the verb he comes. He came there of his own free will, didn't he? To that neighborhood, right? It's like, and so he uses this picture, it's like a stag or a deer prancing through the forest. He's going on his way. He's kind of looking around for something to eat and seeing where the other animals are, and his foot gets caught in a snare. And when his foot gets caught in a snare, he can't go anywhere, and that's when the hunter shoots him through the liver. She has trapped him with her words. Now the third one is really, he hurries. And it says, as a bird hastens to the snare, he hurries to the snare. Notice once he makes up his mind he's going to do this, how quick it is. And you could, this would apply to a mouse too. I think we're all familiar with a mouse trap, right? The mouse sees the peanut butter on the trap. He goes, ooh, smells good, and hurries to the peanut butter. What happens? Snap. You know why he gets killed? He doesn't see the trap. And this is like a bird sees the seed and goes, wow, free seed. Trap. That's what he's done in this snap decision. He's taking what he wants. He wants what she's giving because she has led him to this. And he's out looking for something. And he sees it and he goes after it and he's trapped. What's this mean? Just like the ox. Just like the deer. Just like the bird. They're totally unaware that the next move they make is going to kill them. So now Hubbard goes on to say this. The teacher knows this. The bedroom is a slaughterhouse and the lad is a dumb ox who walks blandly into the butcher's knife, or a stag who prants gleefully to the hunter's noose, only to feel the bite of the arrow in his liver, or a bird flitting into the snare that spells its dooms. I like the way he put that. I like that. The final warnings in 24 through 27. Here's the warning. Now, therefore, my sons, listen to me. And this is like, please listen to me. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her path. Don't even go into her neighborhood. Why was he in that neighborhood? There are many victims she has cast down, and numerous are all her slain. Her house is the way to Sheol, the grave, the end of life, descending to the chambers of death. Prostitution is part of the death culture. But worse than prostitution is adultery. It's absolutely part of the death culture. And this is the description of the death culture. So our culture says, be free. You won't die. Proverbs is known as immune to folly. Not even this young man who doesn't know much. He's not immune to it. So be free. You're not going to die. This isn't going to kill you. This is an experiment that will may expand your life. This may make your marriage better. You ever heard that? But sexual freedom is a culture of death. STDs, violence, murder, abortion, suicide. And you know, the guy who's writing this book, he knows this firsthand. Because who's his father?
David.
David, the great king, brought death into his house. And Solomon knows of the destruction of adultery firsthand. Because he saw what happened to David's sons. Now, you think, well, Solomon, then he would see this and he would learn. Yeah. No, Solomon, the wisest of all the rulers of Israel, wise in his in the way he could rule, but certainly not wise in the ways of women and immorality, because he brought death, not to just his house, his entire nation. Yeah. So this is men, great men, who both gave in to lust, and lust made fools of them both. David and Solomon are not like this young man on the street. They're not naive. They're not without experience. They're not simpletons. You can take the greatest man or the greatest mind, and lust will reduce him to, what Hubbard say? Mindless fool. Puts him in a stupor. Okay, that's the story. That's the illustration. I think it's a good one. I think it's very picturesque. But what are the consequences? Choice determines life. That's what Proverbs always teaches. Choice determines life. Chapter 5, that's where he starts. Chapter 5 is all about adultery, the whole chapter. Chapter 5, here's the outline. Derek Kidner defines life and death according to Proverbs, and we don't think of it this way. Life and death are terms for focusing on earthly blessing or difficulty. This is the way Proverbs views life and death. Earthly blessing or difficulty, but there is at least an inference that there is life or death beyond the grave. Life after death lies beyond the horizon of Proverbs. It's not clear, but there are two sayings about natural death which draw attention to some form of hope. And this is in the book of Proverbs. And here's these two sayings, these two Proverbs. One is 11:7. When the wicked dies, his hope perishes. And the expectation of the wealth perishes as well. So every plan he had for his life, for his wealth and his riches, it's gone. Now the other one is the antithesis to that. The wicked is overthrown through his evil doing, but the righteous finds refuge, or the Hebrew word also means hope here, or protection, in his death. So that means for the righteous, death is not a bad thing. There's really no theology of life after death, like heaven, in the book of Proverbs. In fact, it's very hard to find even in the Old Testament. So that gets clarified by Jesus himself when he starts to talk about resurrection to eternal life. I am the resurrection and the life that's greater than the life of this world, the life of wealth and the life of prosperity and the life of health. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies. Why? Because if you believe in him, you are righteous, and for the righteous, there's hope in death. See that? See how that ties together with that Proverbs saying? I think it's fantastic. So chapter 5, the consequences. Choice determines life. Agony or ecstasy. The seduction. Look at chapter 5. My son, give attention to my wisdom. Incline your ear to my understanding, that you may observe discretion, that your lips may reserve knowledge. For the lips of an adulteress drip honey, and smoother than oil is her speech. But in the end she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lay hold of Sheol, that's the grave. She does not ponder the path of life. Her ways are unstable, and she doesn't know it. She's totally deceived. She eats, wipes her mouth, says, I've done nothing wrong. Now, I want you to notice something. We find an arc here, or a theme, that starts in 5, 1 through 6 and goes all the way to what we just finished reading in 7, 24 through 27. If you read 7, 24 through 27 and 5, 1 through 6, they really look a lot alike. There's some things added. There's some elements added here in 5, 1 through 6. Her lips drip honey. Her speech is smooth like oil. She's flattering in her speech. She makes a really good argument. She entices you. Now, the problem with honey and oil is they can spoil. Oil can become rancid. Honey can become bitter simply by sitting or misuse or overheating. And he's saying here is what's going to happen with her is her oil may look good and her honey may seem so sweet when you first taste it, but it's going to kill you because it's going to be like wormwood, and wormwood is deadly. And not only that, what she's going to tell you is like a two-edged sword. It's going to cut you one way and then cut you another way. And that's going to kill you. But you have this arc from 5 to 7. There's more than just sexual folly. There are other things that seduce us, as outlined in chapter 6. But we're only going to focus on one topic because I don't want to get too complicated. But notice her end. Her end, it's the end of the path you've chosen. What looks so exciting and fulfilling will end in your death. Now, death here doesn't mean you're going to drop over dead, because as I pointed out in Proverbs when we first started, a proverb is not a promise that something will happen, is it? The proverb is the likelihood that if you go this way, here's what's going to happen. So what it says here is, if you are enticed by her, you will die. Did David die from adultery? Did Solomon die from adultery? Does anybody you know that's committed adultery? We all know someone who has. Are they dead because of their adultery? Maybe. But is it guaranteed? No. In this case, this death he's talking about means separation and loss. Separation from what? Well, you're going to break up your marriage. You're going to break up your family. You're going to lose your job. You're going to lose your money. Tremendous loss. That's death. See, for the book of Proverbs, losing those things is death. You're walking dead. Are you going to die physically someday? Yeah. But it's not a direct cause and effect. That's never really true in every case in Proverbs. Even the promises. The promises are not dead guarantees that if you do this, this will happen. No, if you do this, this is likely to happen, but there's still a God that can intervene. And in the case of adultery, God can intervene. Please believe that. God can intervene. So now, let's look at the agony of adultery, 5, 7 through 14. Here's the agony. Now then, my sons, listen to me. Do not depart from the words of my mouth. Notice he says it again. He just keeps saying this. Keep your way far from her and do not go near the door of her house, lest you give your vigor to others. Now here's where it gets important. And your years to the cruel one. Now I think the expression to the cruel one is the injured husband of the woman who you've had this affair with. And he goes on to say, lest strangers be filled with your strength and your hard-earned goods go to the house of an alien, that's the stranger, that's this cruel stranger who's now got it in for you. And I think you'll see that this may not look like this as you're reading through it here, but I think you'll see that as we go through the passage, that becomes clearer, that there is revenge and retaliation for adultery. Now here's the thing, you groan at your latter end when your flesh and your body are consumed. Remember David in Psalms wrote about, as long as he hid this sin and he wouldn't confess it, it's like his bones were broken and he had a fever and he couldn't sleep and he couldn't eat. He was being consumed by guilt, by regret. And this is how verse 11 starts, with this process of regret and guilt. And you say, how I have hated instruction. That's musar. That's discipline. I hated discipline, and my heart spurned reproof. That's correction. I hated to be corrected. And I have not listened to the voice of my teachers, nor inclined to the ear of my instructors. I was almost in utter ruin in the midst of the assembly and the congregation. Look all that's taken place here. The crushing regret. That's a mental burden that you can't escape from. Every day and every night, you got this agonizing regret and this guilt and this, what's going to happen? You don't know what's going to happen. It's a loss of honor. It's a loss of time. All these things are described in here. It's a loss of health. It's a loss of wealth. It's a loss of your children's inheritance. Lest your strangers be filled with your strength, you give your vigor to others. The hard-earned goods go to the house of an alien. It's the loss of your reputation. I was in the midst of utter ruin. I was almost in utter ruin in the midst of the assembly and congregation. I think the word is almost is in there on purpose. I was nearly at utter ruin. I think it gives a hint that there is a way out, but it's just a hint. So you're condemned by your own conscience. This is the saying here. Your own conscience is condemning you. That's not bad enough, though. You're condemned publicly by other people. And not only that, you're blackmailed and you're harassed by the wronged husband. So here's what Hubbard says. Look at this. Shattering, soul-destroying effect of adultery is the point here. It can rarely be kept secret, and its perpetrators are damned if it is kept secret, and damned if it's not kept secret. Kept hidden, it grinds the spirit and the conscience of those who practice it, until exposure seems a kind of relief. But the problem with the exposure and with finally I don't have to live under the secret anymore, what's the relief they get? Shame, humiliation, and loss of respect. That's Hubbard, page 1992. Now let's look at the opposite. Here's what God promises. The opposite of adultery is the ecstasy of fidelity. Married love. 15, drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? Let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth as a loving hind and as graceful doe. Let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated with her love. For why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all paths. Just like the teacher from the window in chapter 7. He sees everything, but you don't know he's watching. I want you to know he's up in that lattice window. He's watching you. He knows what's going on. Verse 22, his own iniquities will capture the wicked, and he will be held with the cords of his sin. The sin you commit is like stepping into a trap. And you're caught in your sin. You can't get out. He will die for lack of instruction. And in the greatness of his folly, he will go astray. Lack of instruction. Lack of discipline. Lack of musar. In their Mideast culture, family was everything. If someone took your wife, that was an insult that we can't imagine. We don't see that in our culture today. Bruce Welke makes this point, and he's an expert in the book of Proverbs, and Sherry and I have been listening to him, and I pulled out something he said. In our world, we are losing our sense of shame about these things. We can talk and hear about adultery, and we don't have that stabbing sense of loss of face, and what a disgrace, and what shame. And I have to agree with him. You know, you think about it, in our country, just go back 50 years, where what was covered up 50 years ago is now shameful and up out in the open. And in the last 20 or 30 years, vulgarity, even coming from government institutions, is being normalized. Well, that's just the way they are. It's a degradation that's so slow, we don't recognize it. And the ecstasy of fidelity is not the loss of freedom. Being united and being bound and being loyal to one woman is not the loss of freedom, but we think it is. He's kind of contrasting fresh water with oil and honey. You have to go back and think of oil and honey. They can become rancid. They can become spoiled. Fresh water is always fresh. Why? Because it's a running stream. And it's a running stream that fills the cistern. So it's always fresh. It's guarded in a cistern. And it's always being replenished. And it's never going to diminish. And it's not going to spoil. Now, should your springs be dispersed abroad? Streams of water in the streets? This is a metaphor for marital love. And what does marital love produce? Children. You want to disperse your married love out there on the streets where you will then father children that are just going to be loose, that are going to be unsupervised? Think of water in a cistern and in a stream that's well controlled. Now think of a flood. It's water, but it's destructive. This is the analogy that he's painting. There is water that in its proper use is very good, but water running in the streets dispersed abroad, that's a flood. And he says in verse 17, let them be yours alone. Let these springs be yours alone. Cistern, it's a reference to the wife who produces children who are a blessing. Let this be your own. The idea is here, are you going to put your wife out on the street? She's yours. Let this fountain produce children that are going to be your inheritors and your blessing and your legacy. From homes of high character come children of high character. Houses that have no character are going to produce children of no character. That mean a good child can't come from a bad home? No. But what's likely to happen? How do you want to engineer your life? You want life to be a crapshoot? I'll do what I want, and if something good happens, good. No, you don't want to live like that. That's what the emphasis here is. So the family is the foundation of culture. It is a school of wisdom and discipline. That the loss of family equals the end of a nation. That was the lesson that David and Solomon had to learn the hard way. Promiscuity and adultery lead to a waste of all that is good. That's verse 20. Why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? That goes back up to verse 16. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? You go out to an adulteress, your children are going to be born outside of your family. You have no control over them. The teacher asks them, why waste your ecstasy on the adulteress? It is losing all the control of your very life. Your inheritance, everything goes with it. There's a word here that we don't want to look at. The word shagah. In Hebrew, the word shagah means to go astray, to err. It also means intoxication, like with wine. There's three verses that I want to point your attention to. Verse 5:19, to stagger as when drunk, loss of control or ecstasy. This word is used in 5:19. As a loving hind, as a grateful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated with her love. If you want to go into a stupor of sensual excitement, let it be with your wife. That is good. That is total ecstasy. You lose control in that moment. And that says God is good. But verse 20, why do that with a prostitute or with an adulteress? That's captivity. That's not ecstasy. Captivity, same word, but that's a bad thing. You're caught in the snare of your sin. And then there's 5:23, is where this word is used for the last time. He will die for lack of instruction in the greatness of his folly. He will shagah. He will stagger around like a drunk. Total loss of control. Folly leads you to a total loss of control of your life. Shagah. So he takes this word and puts it in all three of these verses to show you the contrast in what this loss of control can be a beautiful, wonderful thing, where the blessing is absolutely beyond your control, but so are the consequences of captivity and folly. Okay, we're going to close here. This is a new section, actually, in the book. It's in the middle of chapter 6. He's going to talk about other things at the first part of chapter 6, But 20 through 26 of chapter 6, he talks about loss of life, loss of wealth. My son, observe the commandments of your father. Do not forsake the teaching of your mother. Bind them continually on your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you walk about, they will guide you. When you sleep, they will watch over you. When you wake, they will talk to you. For the commandment is a lamp, and the teaching is light. And reproofs for discipline, that is all, that could be the correction for discipline. That's musar. In the Hebrew, it says, the way of life, correction of discipline. The way of life is always a way where you're constantly being corrected, you're constantly looking at your behavior, and you're adjusting through disciplinary efforts on your part. Or maybe it has to be on the part of someone else, if you're a simpleton and haven't learned enough yet. To keep you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress, do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her catch you with her eyelids. Don't look. Don't look upon things that will produce the fire of lust in your heart. That means pictures. That means images. For on the account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread. This is verse 26. And an adulteress hunts for the precious life. Now there's a difference between the prostitute and the adulteress. The prostitute is doing what she does for money. The adulteress is on a hunt to take everything you've got. She wants you. When he says here, loss of wealth, loss of life, the question he would pose, and I posed it already, is it possible to commit adultery without any consequences? Maybe. But it's not likely. Can the Lord forgive adultery? We know that from David. We know that from Solomon. Can the Lord lessen the consequences of adultery? Yes. Depends on how far you're willing to go before you will give up. But the question is, will he? See, there's the great unknown. He controls the consequences. We don't control him. But you know what we do control? The choices we make. The choices we make. The choices we make will have the consequences that he is in control of. The father warns here that there's always a cost, even with a prostitute. Verse 26, on account of a prostitute, one is reduced to a loaf of bread. That's going to cost you. There's going to be a loss. But with adultery, it's even more dangerous. The comparison here is from lesser to greater. He's making a comparison here between the quality of the degradation. The warning is that there is always loss. Now look at 27 to 29. Fire is dangerous. Is fire dangerous? He's asking the question. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Meaning, can he put fire in his lap and his clothes not be burned? Can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? What's the logical answer to both those questions? No. Is it possible that you can use fire and not be burned or not be hurt? Yes, it is. It depends on how it's used. If you burn your clothes, that's material loss. But if you burn your feet, that's irreversible scarring. There's not only material loss, there's irreversible scars that will not go away if you do this, if you burn yourself with fire. If you commit adultery, sexual immorality will cost you materially, and it will mark you forever in your culture, in your family, in your life. 30 through 35, here's where we close up. Here's the jealous husband. 29, so is the one who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her will not go unpunished. The Hebrew there is will not be innocent. Well, cannot wipe his mouth, say, I've done nothing wrong. Men do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he's hungry. But when he is found, he must repay sevenfold. He must give all the substance of his house. The one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He's lacking heart. He's stupid. He's naive. You could say it all these ways. He who would destroy himself does that. Wounds and disgrace he will find, and his reproach will not be blotted out. That's the consequence. For jealousy enrages a man, and that's the man who's been wronged. And he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not accept any ransom, nor he will be content though you give him many gifts. Meaning there's no end to the demands he will make on you for what you've done with his wife. Because he has lost face in this culture. He has been disgraced. And he is going to disgrace you. So what the teacher does here, he compares the thief to the adulterer. He's not saying stealing is okay, it's going to cost you. Adultery is really bad. No, both are bad. The point is that both are bad, but one people have sympathy for, the other one, no matter what your excuse. The hungry man who hasn't had anything to eat, he steals a loaf of bread. People say, well, at least we understand he was hungry, he was starving. But a man can't say, well, I had to have sex or I was going to die. No, you can't get away with that. Stealing is compared with adultery. That's one promotes sympathy, one promotes contempt. How ought we in the church today, outside this culture, in a culture that we're in, that kind of accepts this as normal, how do we deal with adultery within the church? Number one, we must always urge repentance. Stop the relationship. You cannot continue doing this. But once the person stops and repents and no longer wipes his mouth and says, I've done no wrong, but falls into the remorse that we read about in chapter 5, I wish I'd have listened, the crushing guilt, like David, then you forgive. And so there's got to be healing of a lot of relationships, and that takes time. And it not only takes time, it takes an absolute, steely, determined commitment to do this, both on the person that's done the wrong thing, but the people who've been wrong, and also the people who are involved in trying to counsel and trying to help the person to restore, because that's the goal of the church, to restore these relationships, to restore people to wholeness. Now, if you've walked across fire, there's always going to be scars. It'll get to the point where it no longer hurts, but there's always going to be evidence there. But, you know, the church can't do the other thing either. The church can never condone or look away from adultery, from what's going on. If it's not dealt with, it destroys the character of the church, just the way it destroys the character of the home. And if we destroy the character of the home, where do we get our people to run the church? From homes. If we destroy the character of the home, we destroy the character of the church. And if we destroy the character of the church, we have nothing to say to anybody. As far as the society, I don't think we stand in judges of our culture. I don't think God calls us to judge the culture. He calls us to judge each other in the church. Immorality is a sin that we can say to the world is forgiven by the cross of Christ. That's the light we hold forth. Any immorality can be forgiven. And I'm afraid that we in the church today, as I look around and hear people talk, that we are seen by the world as vindictive judges of all that is wrong with our country. We lose our credibility as people see us as standing as judges over them and not as people who forgive them because Christ forgave us. If we miss that, if we don't get that, we might as well go golfing on Sunday. We have got to be able to forgive the worst things in the worst people. And that's not fair. Because you know what forgiveness is? Think about it. What's forgiveness? You're letting them off the hook, scot-free. And I'm going, we need wisdom in the church. Without wisdom, we are scattered sheep. We look for someone who can rescue us. And sometimes the strongest voice in the room is the most evil person in the society. Because we lack wisdom, we will follow. We need wisdom. Now next week, we're going to look at lady wisdom. Two rival banquets are described in the book of Proverbs. Lady wisdom has sent out her servants and she calls from the highest point of the city, let all who are simple come to my house. But Dame Folly sits at the door of her house on the seat of the highest point of the city, calling out to those who pass by, who go straight on their way, let all those who are simple come to my house. Look who they're calling. They're both calling for the same kinds of people. In fact, Lady Wisdom says, not only the simple, but let the fools, those of you who are messed up already, why don't you come too? I'll take you just as you are. You don't have to clean up. Just come in. Let all who are simple come to my house. They both say the same thing. One is death, one is life. Lady Wisdom speaks truth. Truth is life. Dame Folly doesn't speak truth. She flatters. Her promises are lies. The simple and the fool choose to believe them because they're easier to believe. They're easier to follow because they offer the soft way, the easier way, the way of no correction, the way of no discipline. I can just kind of coast along and everything's going to be great. That's the lie. Dear Father, we do thank you for your word. Thank you so much for your grace and your mercy.